Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter. Join us at KUOW. Thank you for tuning in today. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray resigned 5 months ago facing allegations of child sexual abuse. Now the Seattle Times is publishing texts and emails that give a behind-the-scenes look at a mayor trying to save his career and a city government divided over how and whether to help him. Times reporter Lewis Kam, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
You begin with the story of a surprising phone call to Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez. What was that about?
Right. So this would have been in July, right after the Seattle Times reported on a new story regarding new records that had come to light about a CPS investigation in Oregon in 1984 that basically concluded that Ed Murray had sexually molested his foster son or abused him in 1984. So Jeff Reading was Murray's private spokesman, who had been his ally for more than a decade, going back to Murray's years in the State House. And he called up Lorena Gonzalez, who was then considering calling for Murray's resignation. And the surprise was that he told her he totally supported her, and he encouraged her to, quote unquote, go as bold as possible in calling for Murray's resignation. And he was doing this secretly behind Murray's back. He was still publicly defending Murray against these allegations as his private spokesperson. But clearly, he was privately believing otherwise, so much so that he was secretly reaching out to Councilmember Gonzalez and encouraging her to call for Murray's resignation, really framing the argument for why the story the Times had just reported on the CPS records should have disqualified Murray from being the mayor of Seattle.
Why was Murray's personal spokesperson, Jeff Reading, going behind his boss's back?
Well, clearly, he appears like he was privately conflicted as more and more information was coming to light. Here he was, someone who had known him and was publicly defending him against these allegations, but this was something apparently that he was conflicted about, and as this new information was coming to light, he felt he needed to reach out. Now, Jeff Reading, of course, he didn't want to talk to us for the story, but his text messages, which we got, and you can take a look at it on our story on our website at CLTimes.com, clearly lay out a very detailed view of why he believed Ed Murray should no longer be mayor.
Well, if that spokesperson, Jeff Reading, played any role in helping to push Murray out of office, it's natural to ask what his interest might have been. Do we know what Jeff Reading is doing now? Who's he working for now?
Well, he is a consultant. He's still a consultant with Strategies 360, and he's based out of Portland, and he works on various projects. And Ed Murray had hired him as a trusted person he knew. Obviously, he had worked with him in the past as Murray's spokesperson in the State House, in the Senate, as well as at the city before he went on to private consulting work. And he's still a private consultant. And, you know, is the question is, you know, why was he doing this? Was there any sort of calculation, I guess, for his own political future, that sort of thing? I think it's hard to say. I think what comes across in these text messages, though, is that he felt very strongly in what he was telling. It appears to feel very strongly in what he was telling Councilmember Gonzalez.
You describe years of meetings Murray had with his advisors, assuring them these sex abuse charges would not stick. What are we supposed to take away from that?
Well, I think the takeaway for us was just examining what really was going on behind the scenes with people who were there at City Hall and before, during Ed Murray's career, and living and dealing with this scandal and these allegations as they were kind of possibly bubbling to this. Could be bubbling to the surface and unfolding in real time. And what we needed to do to really tell that story was to get records, the emails, the text messages, and other documents to help us reveal that. All these kind of genuine opinions and feelings from city insiders as they were going on in real time. And what really struck Jim Bruner, my fellow reporter and I, was that these are unvarnished communications that are going on away from the public's eye, so they feel very real in the moment. There isn't kind of this after-the-fact reporting where we're interviewing people and asking, hey, what did you think about this, or how did you feel or act at that point, which generally isn't as genuine in the sense that people might not remember things accurately, or they may try to spin the information in the best possible light. But by and large, this story was built on, you know, the raw feelings and emotions from those key players as they were happening behind the scenes. And our takeaway from all of it was these sexual abuse allegations really haunted Ed Murray for some time, even before they erupted publicly. And at times, they almost bubbled up to the surface while he was a state lawmaker. And they really forced him to strategize and come up with a plan for them if they were to emerge, which they eventually did.
What should Seattle citizens know about how Murray used city resources to fight these sex abuse charges?
Well, and that's another part of the story, and I think that those are fascinating details to us, was this sort of scramble behind the scenes by Murray and his allies to while he was mayor, to retain his position and even to kind of restore his credibility for when he left office. So at times, what we're finding is that, you know, he's asking city employees to help him in, you know, mounting a defense against these allegations that is causing at least one city employee to go to the HR director and say, hey, I'm feeling kind of uncomfortable about this. And then you see like his top deputies trying to round up support from the city council and soliciting support from former mayors. There was, you know, text messages we found of, you know, him reaching out to Charlie Royer and try to get a statement from the former mayors that bolstered him while he was in office. I guess what people should take away is that this was going on behind. This is really a behind the scenes look. And I mean, some of it involves people that are still at City Hall. Some of these text exchanges show, you know, Murray's chief of staff, Mike Fong, for instance, who is now the deputy mayor under Jenny Durkin. He was, you know, texting various council members to see if they were planning to support Gonzalez's call for Murray's resignation. And in one very telling exchange with Sally Bagshaw, a current sitting council member, she is telling Fong, don't worry about this. Gonzalez is grandstanding for political gain, and we've got five votes to protect Murray.
That might be uncomfortable between council members who are being outed having talked about one another like that. You got an online message, and you published an online message from one of Murray's accusers, Lloyd Anderson, and he's saying directly, he's writing on a constituent comment form on the mayor's office website, and he's making allegations very explicitly as if he's talking directly to Ed Murray. Did the mayor's office break any ethics law by not responding to a constituent comment on the mayor's office website?
I don't know that. I don't think that they did. And when I, you know, Ed Murray didn't want to sit down and do an interview with us for this story, but we did have communications with his attorney, Steve Fogg, who, you know, what he says about that is like, look, they got these allegations. These are not true allegations. These were, you know, Lloyd Anderson is someone who in the past had tried to pursue a lawsuit against Ed Murray that didn't go anywhere, and that none of the stuff he was saying on the mayor's website or through this, you know, portal for constituents had anything to do with city business. So,
except that allegations like that one taken together would end up costing city taxpayers money. And speaking of money, we're talking with Seattle Times reporter Lewis Cam. When Murray announced he would not seek re-election, he told the Seattle Times that, quote, except for a tiny pension, I have nothing but my legacy. And you're reporting today that tiny pension is going to pay him more than $115,000 a year for the rest of his life. Is there anything unusual or controversial about that?
Oh, right. Well, no. I mean, essentially, it's just, to me, it was just fascinating. He has both a state pension and a city pension, and he's now drawing retirement benefits about $116,000 annually, and that's an amount higher than what he made in 18 of 21 years in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And but he doesn't appear to be, you know, abusing the system at all. But what he is doing absolutely is taking advantage of each of his pensions. A big reason why his pension is the amount is because is because of his roughly $190,000 salary he made as the mayor of Seattle during his final few years in politics.
Right, that's a big part of determining what your pension is your highest couple of years of earning. So if the city council had forced Murray out of office instead of him voluntarily resigning, would he have forfeited any of that pension?
Not much at all, really. The way it worked out is, you know, Murray ultimately used his first 2 years in office to help calculate his state pension. And it turned out the way it worked out that his final few months really didn't have a whole lot of bearing on the final number he receives.
But if he had been, for example, if he'd have been, you know, pushed out of office officially, I wondered if any of that, if that would have triggered any forfeiture of his. And also wondered, would the city paid $150,000 to settle a lawsuit? You know, could that money come out of Murray's pension? Is there anything about his pension that's sort of
right
in question or could have been?
No, well, in the state of Washington, no. I mean, I know this from past reporting that in this state, even if you've, you know, found guilty of a crime or that sort of thing, you can't lose your pension. Once you become vested, it's yours. You're entitled to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question about whether or not the city, you know, whether or not they should have settled this lawsuit, I think they took that separately from whatever Ed was going to take from a pension or that sort of thing. They took on that issue as mm-hmm. a purely legal exercise, according to city attorney Pete Holmes.
Right.
But, you know, people might wonder that, you know, should the city of Seoul, you know, settled this lawsuit when here Ed Murray actually is making over $115,000 a year in retirement.
Right. That's Seattle Times reporter Lewis Cam reporting on Ed Murray's pension for life and also a kind of TikTok behind-the-scenes look through texts and emails at the mayor trying to save his career and how city government reacted to that. Lewis Cam, Seattle Times, thanks for the reporting and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
We'll be back with more KUOW's The Record in a moment. So have you tried Amazon's new cashier-free convenience store in South Lake Union? You can shop at Amazon Go in as long as it takes you to walk in and grab a sandwich and walk out. However, cameras will track your every move and collect your data. And all that data is being stored by Amazon Web Services, biggest computing cloud in the world. Amazon's cloud has made unbelievable amounts of data available to private companies and governments. That data is reshaping our world and leading to new kinds of conflicts. KUOW's Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph explain in the latest episode of Primed.
So this store opened up in Seattle, Amazon Go. It's like a convenience store, but with no cashiers. There's nobody to pay.
Okay, I've got my sandwich, and I'm going to walk out the door.
There are all these little cameras and sensors everywhere that know what I took.
I didn't know it would work.
It's a little weird, actually. But let's be real here. We're being tracked all the time.
And we help every time we add a new app to our phones.
Yeah, there's this game I play on my phone on the bus. Battle Cats. Tiny cats fight each other and also read my browsing history.
Did you see that crazy story about this company called Strava? It's a free app that tracks things like where people jog, and it sells that data to cities like Seattle. Cities use it to help them plan. But here's the crazy thing. Strava published a heat map of everybody's running routes, including the paths of soldiers running around their secret military bases.
Whoops. So that's three different instances of data tracking us. Amazon Go, my stupid game Battle Cats, and the Strava fitness tracker.
And they all have something in common. All their data is stored at Amazon Web Services.
The biggest cloud in the world. I'm Joshua McNichols.
I'm Carolyn Adolph from KUOW in Seattle. This is Primed. What happens when Amazon comes to your town?
In this episode, we'll talk about how Amazon's cloud has made unbelievable amounts of data available not just to private companies, but to governments. That data is reshaping our world and leading to new kinds of conflicts.
Data is power.
No one thought it would be as big as quickly as it has been.
You know, I don't want someone's social security number. I don't want to know exactly where they live.
We still have a policy environment that's like the Wild West.
We'll be right back.
Before we get into the conflicts brewing in Amazon's cloud, there's something a lot of people may not realize. Amazon Web Services is way bigger than Amazon.com.
And that cloud began as something that Amazon made for itself, a place to put all its customer data and the programs that manage that data. Here's Jeff Bezos.
We realized, wait a second, what we're building here, we need Amazon.com, the retailer, needs these things. But pretty soon, everybody's going to need these things. And so with a little extra work, we can turn what we were going to build just for ourselves into a service for the world.
It turns out you can make a heck of a lot more money selling access to the cloud than you can make selling ski poles and chicken diapers.
What on earth are chicken diapers?
Well, it's just what it sounds like.
But why?
The point is, companies flocked to the cloud.
Oh, set up. This is where we say goodbye to Amazon in this story. Just because Amazon built the cloud doesn't mean it controls all the battles that go on inside it. And there's a huge one brewing between governments and private companies. They both want data, but we view how they use the data very differently. The companies that are taking advantage of the cloud to disrupt industries and to let us do things we could never do before, they get called innovators. But governments that exploit huge amounts of data about us, they get called Big Brother.
Or they get called smart cities. Smart cities use data to run things more smoothly. They kind of have to. Government can't get away with operating like it always has. Today, people expect government to work just as efficiently as Uber does. Kate Garman works for the city of Seattle. She says people now expect to track things like garbage trucks and snow plows, just like you track the progress of an Uber driver.
Now they're like, where is my snow removal? You know, I mean, there's an expectation now, and the private sector is pushing the envelope, and people are now expecting something similar from their government. And it constantly challenges us, but I think it's bettering everyone.
There are lots of ways data could make the city work better. Imagine a city where you can always get where you want to go on time.
It takes some time at this point, Joshua.
Well, work with me here. I mean, I'm talking about utopia. Imagine a city where you can always get to work on time because data-driven algorithms always keep a path open for buses. And if buses are too packed, the transit agency sends more instantly.
Step into the sun, step into the light.
It's almost like the cloud becomes a utility, essential, and most of the time unnoticed. When it works, it makes life better.
For example, there are these hockey puck-sized sensors under the road where Amazon's headquarters is. Traffic congestion there is epic, but those sensors send data to the city, and then the city uses that data to adjust the timing of the traffic lights in real time.
It's decreased the average wait time at a light from 12 minutes to 7 minutes.
So it's about half as ludicrous as it was before.
But there's a dark side to this kind of data collection, too. Some sensors on that street get their data by pinging the cell phones in the car. So the company could figure out exactly who is in what car and who they're with.
I bet location data gets used in divorce cases all the time.
It does. Up next, we look at what all this data collection means for our privacy.
You're out of the woods, you're out of the dark, you're out of the night. Step into the sun, step into the light, march up to the gate and beat it. Open, open.
We've been talking about how data about us in the cloud could help cities run better. And we've heard how that same data raises a tangle of privacy concerns.
I went to talk to Shankar Narayan at the American Civil Liberties Union in Seattle.
The data never goes away, right? So think about it. If you spend time in the wrong neighborhood, you can never erase that.
But I already know I'm being tracked. And in the past, I've just chosen not to get worked up over this. I mean, I'm generating a mountain of data. Who's going to spend the time to sift through all of it? It turns out I was having a very old-fashioned reaction.
You are basing your decisions about the data on the world that exists now, where you think a human being is making a lot of these decisions.
But it's not humans you have to worry about making decisions based on your data. It's computers. For example, a computer can cross-reference your job application with your personal location data and choose not to pass your resume along to the boss because you live too far away, so you don't get a job interview.
Data is power because a great deal of decision-making already is algorithmically oriented, right? So it means a machine is essentially making important decisions or is participating in important decisions that bear on someone's life.
This risk to our personal privacy is one reason why governments have trouble getting the data they want. Another obstacle to governments is corporate privacy. Companies don't want to share data with anyone because it's competitive.
But that data could be really valuable to governments.
Here in Seattle, the city would really like to get its hands on Uber's pickup and drop-off data because all these stopped cars are clogging up streets. Uber's data would help the city limit congestion by making special rideshare drop-off zones.
And not only that, companies say they can't trust the city to protect the data.
Right, because the public records law requires the city to hand this information over to anyone who asks.
Has anyone ever asked?
Of course they did. So Uber and Lyft went to court, and the fight is still on.
So the companies are concerned about their privacy, and individuals have their privacy concerns too. Seattle is trying to wade through that mess. You can see city employees struggling to find the balance in a single office in Seattle's municipal tower, within just a few desks of each other. Kate Garman runs the city's Smart Cities program. She's trying to improve city services by making use of data. She sits right near the city's chief privacy officer.
She and I are the yin and the yang, and we both look at the value of data differently, and it's a constant conversation of, you know, if I had this demographic information block by block, oh my gosh, the things I could do with that for city services. And she looks at it, she's like, oh my God, that terrifies me. We really need to look at that data. And so the goal is to come to a compromise.
You know what's interesting? Seattle just got a report card on this from a privacy watchdog group. It basically said Seattle's doing a good job, but there are still a lot of holes to patch. For example, in Seattle, you can call 311 and ask the city anything, like how to make a noise complaint or how to get rid of a homeless encampment. The record of those calls, though, is public information.
So your neighbor can find out and decide you're a jerk.
Yeah, and this didn't happen here, but in Philadelphia, you know, when people want to apply for a gun permit, they have to fill out what a reason is. And a lot of people put, because I carry large sums of money at night, I need a gun to protect myself, right?
Oh my goodness.
And that data became public. So suddenly, some lawyers who sued the city were calling it a roadmap for criminals because you knew who to target now.
Oh, that just sounds like a nightmare.
So we've just described some extremely bad things that can happen when data about people gets misused. And we've also heard about all the wonderful things cities could do if they had enough data. The utopian and the dystopian are all tangled up together. It's hard to pull them apart so you can keep what's good.
But we have to figure this out because the stakes for a city that's in hyperdrive are high. Here in Seattle, fast growth has given us huge problems with congestion and homelessness and affordability. And governments can't afford to waste money on stuff that doesn't work. Is there a solution out there? Okay, typical Seattle problem. You wake up, and it's pouring rain. So of course you don't ride your bike to work. But then around lunchtime, there's a beautiful sunbreak. And people stream out of their buildings. It's the perfect moment for a bike ride.
That's the one thing about Seattle in the winter is that you have so many days where it gets ticked as a rainy day, but really probably rained for a couple hours, and a lot of the day it was perfectly fine.
That's where bike sharing companies come in. Kyle Rowe works for one called Spin. It's one of three companies that have dropped literally thousands of brightly colored bikes on the streets of Seattle since last summer.
They're all over the place.
And guess what? All those bikes are collecting data, and they're sending it into the cloud. Someday the bike share companies may use that data to advertise to users, but they also know right now that data is really valuable to cities. Here's Kyle Rowe.
I mean, just simply knowing how many trips are happening, where are the trips happening, where are trips happening that are directly parallel to transit routes.
That could help the city lay out bike routes.
But remember those problems that were getting in the way of data sharing before? They're all still there.
Except now there's a plan to get around them. It's being piloted here in Seattle. The University of Washington is experimenting with taking raw data from companies, stripping it of identifying information, aggregating it, organizing it so it's meaningful, and giving it to government.
You take away the names, you take away phone numbers, you take away email addresses, and then presumably you will have met the requirements to quote-unquote anonymize that data.
This is Jan Whittington. She's a professor in the Department of Urban Design at the University of Washington. And she's come up with an idea. Use her research to create a black box that will shield data from prying eyes and give the city something useful.
We're subject to different rules under the Public Records Act. So that may allow us to be a sort of an intermediary, someone who can act as a repository for sensitive data, to compile this data from multiple sources, public and private.
It's not a perfect solution, because it's possible to reverse engineer anonymous data so it can identify people. But it's a start. The bike share companies have agreed to be the guinea pigs, and now Uber says it's interested in the idea.
So what does that kind of data sharing mean to someone living in the city?
Well, my evening bus is often too full, and it leaves me out on the street in the rain. Right now, I can get one of the bike share bikes, and I can pedal to a less popular stop. But maybe someday, I won't even have to do that, because the transit service will finally see the demand and they'll add a bus. That's my data sharing dream.
So we've been talking about data and how it can lead our cities to utopia or dystopia and how they're all tangled up together. Somehow we have to figure out a way to live with that. Even Shankar Narayan from the ACLU has apps on his phone that he knows track him sometimes.
It shouldn't be a choice between getting the benefit of a technology and giving up your privacy.
We have a history of gradually adapting to small invasions of our privacy as a trade-off for cool stuff.
Yeah. Remember the first time Google fed you an ad for something you've written about in your Gmail?
Yeah, I remember that. At first, I was creeped out by that.
And we're used to that now. As the internet gets better and better at digging into our lives, the stakes will get higher. I mean, ads are one thing, but that's nothing compared to having all your personal data out on the dark web somewhere.
We're just going to have to learn to stay on guard.
Check out past episodes of Primed at KUOW.org, also on iTunes, Stitcher. It's findable on all of your podcast machines. Coming up, San Francisco will wipe thousands of misdemeanor marijuana convictions. We'll talk about that in a moment. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Since Washington State legalized marijuana use 5 years ago, State lawmakers have repeatedly decided not to wipe out the criminal records of people who have old marijuana convictions. Well, San Francisco's just made a different decision. Yesterday, San Francisco's district attorney announced the city will expunge thousands of marijuana convictions. San Francisco District Attorney George Cascone, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
First of all, what are the stakes here? When you have a marijuana conviction on your record, how does that hold you back?
Sure. So, I mean, any criminal conviction is going to have an impact on your ability to get employment, housing, educational loans, join the military. Additionally, if you have a felony conviction, you're unable to vote. You may not be able to get a certain licensing, you know, like sell real estate, medical license, legal, you know, to be an attorney. So there's a cascade of impacts that flow from having a criminal conviction. Here in California, when the voters passed Prop 64, they made it very clear that they wanted the war on marijuana and the war on drugs to stop. It passed overwhelmingly, just like it did in Washington, by the way, and in San Francisco by over 75%. Now, Prop 64 also included the capacity of the individual to petition the court to have their misdemeanor conviction expunged or their felony conviction reduced to a misdemeanor. However, the mechanism was one where you have to hire an attorney and you have to file the petition, you have to appear in court. We researched this and we came to the conclusion that that really puts the people that are most harmed by this, which is usually poor people, people of color, African-American communities have been decimated by the war on drugs, at a disadvantage because they don't have the funding, they don't have the capacity often to come to court to petition this. Mm-hmm. You know? So we decided that we would do this for them and we would do it en masse. So we are going to basically expunge all misdemeanor convictions.
But not felonies?
Well, so felonies is a different mechanism, right? Felonies, you have to review the person's criminal record because if you have a prior felony conviction for a violent crime, you do not qualify for relief. So we would have to review to make sure that the person doesn't have any disqualifying conviction. If they don't, then we would reduce we would resentence that person to a misdemeanor.
Okay. Speaking of violent crimes, sometimes people who are accused will plead guilty to a less serious offense in order to get a lighter sentence. So what are the odds that you are expunging the records of people who actually did something more serious than possess a drug that's now legal?
Well, look, I mean, I think there's two things that we have to look at. Number one, an arbitrary line that was drawn between when a statute was created and before that should not be the line that determines whether you're going to have a criminal record for the rest of your life or not, number one. Number two, you know, I hear people say, well, you know, people that commit robbery, sometimes they have marijuana in their system, but they got prosecuted for marijuana. Well, guess what? People that commit robberies drink alcohol. We don't prosecute them because they were drunk. We prosecute them because they committed a robbery, right? So I think it's a false premise, and I think we need to move away from that. You know, as a prosecutor, if you committed a serious offense and I can prove that, then so be it. If I cannot, then move on and look for another case.
Well, as you know, in Washington State, we've had this discussion. We've been deciding whether to expunge criminal records. And one of the arguments against doing that is, yes, the law has changed now, but the people convicted of these marijuana offenses were knowingly committing crimes. Why not hold them accountable for breaking the law it was then?
Yeah, you know, my response to that is because you had an unjust law for years does not mean that you should continue to punish the people that fell under that premise. I mean, if you make that argument, assuming that we were just a few years after the Civil War, we could argue that some people should continue to be slaves because they were slaves when it was legal to do so, right? Again, I mean, I think this argument
is very hard. Well, isn't that different from knowingly breaking the law as it was then? That's the argument.
You know, let me move it to you in a different direction. You have a law that has lost credibility. You know, the majority of Americans believe that marijuana should be legalized in some form. So just because you had what I would consider a very wrong-headed policy at the national level, should we continue to punish people for doing that? Number one. Number two, let me give you what I consider to be even a more compelling argument. drug use in America is equal use across the racial lines. In fact, some people would argue there are studies that actually show that white Americans, especially middle and upper class, are more likely to use drugs, especially marijuana, than poor people. However, when you look at the impact of the criminal justice system, and you look at the number of people that get arrested for drug possession or drug use, it is disproportionately African American. I can give you the example of my city, which is one of the most progressive cities in the country. 50% of our marijuana arrests are African American. 5% of our population is African American. You tell me, how could that be fair and moral under any rubric?
San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon, you have plenty of people who agree with you here in Washington State as we continue to consider the decision that San Francisco has taken, reviewing and wiping out some marijuana convictions. George Gascon from San Francisco, thanks for this conversation.
My pleasure, Bill. Take care.
We talked with King County's prosecuting attorney, Dan Satterberg. He says when marijuana was legalized, King County dismissed and declined all marijuana possession cases that were in the pipeline, but the county has no plans to go back and find old cases to dismiss like San Francisco's doing. Now imagine you're on a long drive across Washington State. It's snowy. You're on a dark country road. You're tired, maybe tempted to take a nap, but you're carrying precious cargo. Not logs, not apples, not fish. You're carrying words. Such is the life of the Washington State Poet Laureate. And last night, there was a changing of the guard. Gonzaga professor Todd Marshall handed the laurel wreath to Claudia Castro Luna. She's an immigrant from El Salvador and the first person of color to hold the title. Todd, you have a deep love of language, but you ask people to tell you the words they hate. Why did you do that? And what's the most hated word in Washington?
There's an immediate top three that I'll share in just a second. But, you know, I think that I share that conversation with people, you know, usually as a foil against the words that we love question, because we all have words that we just love to hear. We love to chew on when we say them. They're music to our ears. But then there's the cringe list. Moist, number one.
I've heard that. People hate the word moist.
All ages, all demographics, moist is the most reviled word.
That would have been news to my home cake-baking mother, who I remember that being a wonderful word, but I've heard that.
Two and three are slacks and chunks.
Slacks and chunks. Yeah,
there's something about that sibilance that maybe, I don't know, but those are the three cringe words. And that's usually a starting point. And then the answers that people start to share, you know, go away from that. And maybe they'll start sharing words that connect to personal experience and have all of the baggage of memory that make them so reviled. You know, but it's a fun entry point just thinking about the sounds of words and how sounds can make us cringe.
Claudio, is there a word you hate? Could you imagine?
Oh, my God. No, I was thinking more the opposite, actually. I was thinking of the way words, like you said, contain. They're more than just these, you know, these syllables or these letters, right? They really contain memory and really selfhood. So I was thinking of the word mango, for instance. What? It's a fruit, right? It's a fruit that we could purchase at the supermarket. And yet for me, mango is not just a mango, you know? I don't even buy mangoes because I love them so much that the ones I see don't quite measure up to the ones I remember. And every time I see a mango or I say the word mango, it is a whole flood of stories that run immediately parallel in my head. And I know that we all have words like that that are so full of meaning that just, they're not just simple words, you know? So I was just thinking more in the opposite sense of the memories that word contains in a sense of selfhood that is often attached to, you know, what could be a simple word.
Your selfhood feels attached to the word mango?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything about my childhood is centered around, and I've written about mangoes and how they are, you know, undersats for home in a way, undersats for family. And when I say family, of course, I think of my dad climbing the mangoes or stories of gathering mangoes when they fell or mango season. I mean, these are multiplicity of thoughts and emotions that just flood in me at the mention of that. So it's identity in a way, you know, the way some words work and are able to trigger all of that like a floodgate.
Let's talk about our state. You work at Gonzaga University. You live in Spokane. Did you try to build a bridge across the Cascade Curtain?
Well, I think that I was really attentive when I had events on the west side of the Cascades. You know, I would try to make bridges in terms of the physical beauty of our state. I would also try to mention amazing writers and artists connected with the opposite side of the mountains from where I was currently speaking. And so, you know, I just tried to make people aware of how there are, you know, incredibly thoughtful, incredibly artistically inclined, wonderful people throughout the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm. I got invited, actually, by Todd to come over to Wenatchee to do a poetry writing workshop in Spanish. And there we were, the two of us, in January, snow, cold, Wenatchee. And the crowd was very mixed. I mean, there were some Latino young students there and also local folks, older white folks, you know. But after the reading, there was three young people who stood on the sidelines and came to talk to me. And part of the poems talked about mythic figures of El Salvador. You know, these are legend figures. And I wove them into a poem. When I read the poem, I thought, nobody's going to get this, but this is the poem I brought and I will read it. And so it turns out that two of those kids were born in the U.S., but of Salvadoran parents, and had never heard these stories, which was quite astounding for me that they, I mean, this is like pure core of a Salvadoran person would be to know these mythic characters.
You would think their parents in the States would pass that on?
Yes, yes.
Did you find out why they
hadn't? I was surprised because my own children know this story because I've told them, you know. But I think it has to do with erasure of painful memories as well. The kids also talked about the Salvadoran Civil War as the reason why their parents were here and how they never talked about this. The parents never talked about the war and perhaps many other things that are part of being Salvadoran, you know, that got kind of missed in that kind of erasure. So it was just a very touching evening for me, and that I connected with these young people. And
I do want to ask your reflection on that. Just, it occurs to me, that's another little tragedy, is that from that conflict, it sounds like, that these kids lost a bit of their parents and a bit of their culture.
Yep.
Now what do you remember about that day?
Well, what's fascinating is listening to Claudia talk about it brings back the day. And I've kind of, you know, in the last 3 weeks been in that reminiscing mode and, you know, looking at places on the map and going, oh my gosh, I remember this restaurant there. Oh my gosh, I remember this poet there. Oh my gosh, you know, that's the first time I met Tom Robbins or whatever. But that day began with the Women's March.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
and
did.
Oh, really?
So it began with a, you know, a really visceral outpouring of people. And, you know, it was a day where, you know, I think we felt a little empowered. I think that we felt a little bit frustrated. I recall one car of teenagers. I think they were in a, I'm guessing they're teenagers, but maybe a Volkswagen of some sort, kind of circling around and taunting us the whole time. And that was the only real ugliness that transpired. But I remember that march unfolding. And then going straight into poetry stuff after that and doing the workshops with the communities and then the evening reading and feeling at the end of the night hopefulness that I hadn't felt in a few days, that I hadn't felt in a few weeks because I saw how words brought people together.
Mm-hmm. You want to create a book of poems about stories of arrival in Washington State, is that right?
Yes. You know, I mean, the idea is to put together a book that is about how do we find common ground in a state that is so broad, so differently, with so many different geographical areas and ecosystems, both people-wise and just nature as well. And what is something that we could both reflect, all of us reflect back on? And thinking about that, I landed on this idea that this is a very new state. It's only 129 years old. And I think there's trees in Washington that are older than 129 years old. And so I'm thinking that most people in the state have in their personal histories, in their family histories, some story of arrival. Somebody came to Washington and toiled or worked very hard and found their way in. And just as they came 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 75 years ago, we have new people coming in. So I think that that is an area of common ground, and I'd like to explore that some more. And the original idea was to, for myself, to write poems, my own poems, about stories of arrival and think about all the different arrival stories in Washington State. But now as I speak about it, I think, you know, maybe the idea is to collect stories, just a series of poems that could be almost like broadsides that then could be shared in libraries across the state.
What would your arrival story in that book be?
Well, I came to Washington because my husband is a housing activist, and he got recruited to work for King County. And we had been in California for a while, and I had given up my job as a teacher coach. I was a master teacher coaching teachers in the schools, and I had given it all up to go and write poetry. And so I was at a very good time where I didn't have an employer. I was writing, and so I could move, and that's how we came. And the surprising thing about me is that from the moment I got here, I find a deep affinity to Seattle. It's been very striking for me because as somebody from Central America, it seems like the farther north I've gone in my 37 years of living in the U.S., the more at home I feel. I mean, I'm as close to being in a different country at this point, I think, as I'll ever get.
Why do you think you feel more at home as you travel north in the States?
You know, I don't know. The weather is absolutely different. I don't know if it's more of a personal temperament with the landscape and the weather and just the pace of life and the people and the community of writers that I have found here. It might be that. I think it has to do more with a personal temperament.
Todd Marshall, what arrival story would you write?
Well, I was thinking about that. You were talking south to north. I came east to west. I was born in Buffalo, New York, and I came to Washington in 1999 purely for mercenary reasons. The academic job market makes one go where a job is available, and so I arrived at Gonzaga. And now I've lived here much, much longer than any other place that I ever stayed in my life, and I think that I was very attached to Washington State in 2016. Now Washington State is imprinted upon me. All of the different back roads, all of the different towns, all of the different scenic vistas, I think, are now a part of me in a way that is pretty compelling.
We're talking about words here appropriately with our incoming and outgoing Washington State Poet Laureates. Claudio Castro Luna, the new one, Todd Marshall, outgoing poet laureate. What do you want to say to listeners who maybe don't feel as comfortable with words and poetry yet as you do? What do you want to say to them about what poetry can be?
Well, I think in some ways my journey as Washington State Poet Laureate changed from being a journey revolving specifically around talking about how important poetry is to a journey that was trying to advocate how words matter. And so early on at a lot of my events, I talked about memorizing poems and how memorizing a poem can be a gesture of welcome. It can be a bridge of sorts between yourself and some other experience, some other vision of the world. I think, though, over the course of my journey, that the message that I tried to deliver is, you know, maybe poetry is the place where you will find those words that matter most to you. And if so, that's awesome. Big thumbs up from Poet Laureate. I'm very happy about that. But the most important thing is that you find words that matter to you, that speak to you, that open the world to you, that show you how the world should be. And you extend them the welcome of letting them into your heart and memorizing them, whether we're talking about words found in the Gettysburg Address or words found in the Bill of Rights or words found in a psalm or a favorite novel. Welcome those words inside of you. Carry them around with you. And I believe that that welcoming gesture, that hospitality of taking the words inside of oneself, I believe that gesture might allow us to be a little more welcoming of the world writ large, of people who are different from us or people who have different experiences from ours. And you know, that might be a first step toward changing things in a positive way.
How about you, Claudia?
Well, I always think of words and the power of story. And, you know, when I was the civic poet of Seattle, I did a whole bunch of workshops across the city at various libraries. And one of my favorite exercises, I just did one actually in the Southwest branch of the public library. And this were to an elderly group. So this is a group of folks that meets to discuss various topics once a month at the library. And this time it happened to be me leading a workshop. And, you know, there's this sense of reticence when I say, oh, you know, this is who I am, and we're going to write a poem, and I guarantee you we're going to all share at the end of, you know, of the hour. And of course, nobody's smiling. And then I usually start with a prompt that taps into memory. I have found it a very useful tool to show where language could take you and how, if you are able to remember, then, you know, you're able to write something. And we all have memories, right? And of course, everybody writes something because they remember. And invariably at the end, they're very surprised that they actually have something on the page that looks very similar, because the use of language in those poems is very, you know, our everyday speech patterns with the music of the everyday in them. And so they're not researched poems. They're really, you know, just kind of first thought, best thought kind of thing. And this last time, a woman sat back after I asked if people want to share a line or read what they wrote. And this woman said to me, well, do you do workshops? You know, do you lead people in workshops? And I said, you know, I don't. I mean, I do workshops like this, and I do workshops in various places, but I don't offer like private workshops or anything like this. She said, this was very useful. I never thought that poetry could be like that. And so for me, it's very much tied to story. And if we're able to capture something that is in our memory about relationships with people or a place, then I think you begin to, I hope that there is something about beginning to glimpse into the transformation of what a poem could do. And that a poem doesn't have to look like a traditional poem in stanzas and with end rhyme, etc., that it could be very much what you're saying in the way in which you say it. And that there's an opening and self-discovery there that happens. That is really, I've loved every time I've been part of that experience, watching in somebody's, in their mood, you know, just sharing what they wrote.
It's not just the poet laureate bringing you poems. It's you're setting off something in your listener.
Yeah, and it's you writing your own. I mean, I think that's what I'm interested in, much more so than sharing my own poems, is you write your own poem. You tell me something, you know, share with me something, share with us something about yourself.
Yeah, let's make some poetry together.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Todd Marshall and Claudia Castro Luna, Washington State Poet Laureates, past and present. On the record, that's all for today's show. Our producers are Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, our social media producer, Bon Huberman. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.